Mr. Hall. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Oliver Hall for appellant Ralph Nader. This case involves the total nullification of congressional intent by the FEC, which deliberately refused to perform its most rudimentary statutory duties in response to the filing of an administrative complaint. As the district court recognized, the FEC directly violated the express terms of the Federal Election Campaign Act and directly violated its own regulations by failing to serve the administrative complaint in this case. The FEC's dismissal of that complaint was therefore contrary to law, and this matter should be reversed and remanded. The district court's conclusion that the FEC's failure to serve the administrative complaint was harmless error is incorrect. In the district court's view, the candidate was required to show that the outcome of this proceeding would have been different had the agency served the administrative complaint. But this court has expressly rejected that view. In Shays v. FEC, the court recognized that a plaintiff need not show that, but for the procedural defect, the final outcome of a rulemaking process would have been different. In fact, the court emphasized that is precisely the showing that administrative cases do not require. And yet that is the showing that the district court required of the candidate in this case.
Let me ask you something. The FEC did serve the DNC, Kerry Committee, several others. Is it your position that the ones that weren't served could have coordinated inter se? I mean, didn't the fact that they didn't serve those people, once they served the ones they did and said there was no reason to believe that there was any violation, and in particular the coordinated aspect of it, there was no one, that's my question, was there anyone in the unserved parties that could have coordinated in an illegal way among themselves?
Your Honor, yes, there certainly is the possibility of illegal coordination among those parties. Because
all right, and leave out the state Democratic parties.
Sure.
If that's what you're...
Well, Your Honor, the allegations here are, of course, a nationwide coordinated effort, coordinated by the respondents here in D.C. who were served, and also coordinated with all these respondent law firms and other parties that were not served. And there is evidence that those parties that were not served coordinated, for example...
With each other. Okay, well, how is that illegal? I mean, you've got the DNC and Kerry Committee in the middle of this wheel, and you've got all these other people, and they've got to coordinate it with the hub, and what does it matter that once... The FEC found that those that had been served in the hub, there was no reason to believe that there was any coordination, that these outer groups may have coordinated with each other.
Your Honor, I may have misspoke. I did not mean to suggest that the fact that law firms may coordinate with one another is itself a violation, although conceivably it could be if they were knowingly transferring, for example, services or other goods of value to the benefit of another law firm, for example, in another state. That could be a violation in that they are facilitating the transfer of something of value for the benefit of the campaign. But in regard to my previous answer, I only meant to suggest that there is evidence of coordination among all these parties. And, for example, one of the complaints that was filed in the state of Maine included as an exhibit a letter that was sent by an elections official in California to one of the respondent attorneys in Pennsylvania. So that letter somehow made its way from Pennsylvania to an attorney filing a complaint in Maine. So there's clearly evidence here that this was a concerted nationwide effort and not, as the respondents have always claimed, individual efforts by individual parties who just happen to have a common purpose in mind. That said, I wanted to underscore that the crucial issue in this case is not, even though we are here on a summary judgment motion, is not whether the evidence proves or satisfies a summary judgment standard with respect to whether a violation occurred. Rather, the issue here is whether the agency violated the act by failing even to serve the complaint, and then determining that the evidence was insufficient to find a violation. You see, the agency put the cart before the horse in making that determination. It was improper for the agency to make a determination that there's no probable cause, no reason to believe that a violation occurred, without even serving the complaint on the parties who are alleged to have committed the violations.
Did you send a copy of the complaint to each one of the parties that were named in it?
Your Honor, did we do that? No, we did not do that, Your Honor. But that is not the procedure that the Federal Election Campaign Act provides for.
I understand that. I just wondered whether you'd done it. May I ask you, you said when you opened that we asked the court to reverse and remand. Are you asking us to send it back to the district court or with instructions to send it to the agency? Is that the idea?
Correct, Your Honor.
What do you expect the Federal Election Commission to do?
Well, Your Honor, we're asking that the FEC be ordered to comply with the act, and that means that it should serve the complaint on the respondent parties, who, by the way, the FEC admits, if the allegations in the complaint are true, they had violated the act. And so
they do that. And each one of the respondents then says, statute of limitations, 5 years, expired 2009. You're talking about a 2004 election. And besides that, there's nothing to enjoin. So what's the relief?
Your Honor, we've never asked for injunctive relief. We have alleged violations of the act insofar as these parties made illegal contributions, corporate contributions, and also insofar as they failed to report those contributions. And that informational injury is still very much a live interest in this case. The candidate here has submitted an affidavit in support of that injury, demonstrating that he has engaged in advocacy on behalf of candidates' rights and the right of voters to have a free choice of candidates in elections since 1959, when he first published his first article on this subject. And he's still engaged in that activity now. And so that information would be very valuable to him in the course of that advocacy.
The information is what again? I'm not sure I caught that.
The information, Your Honor, is the reports that are required by these respondent parties when they make a contribution of something of value to a campaign or for the benefit of the committee. They are required under the Act to report that. And they are also subject to limitations and prohibitions when they make those sorts of contributions and expenditures. So the reports of those transactions are required under the Act, and that is the information, that is at least some of the information that is still being sought here in this case. Second,
okay.
If I could go on.
And is it, let me just ask, and is it his peculiar status as an advocate that gives him the standing of informational injury?
Well, Your Honor, it certainly helps that he is a candidate.
I don't think the question was whether he's a candidate.
No.
It's whether he's an advocate.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's not a candidate. In Shays, there were candidates,
yes.
Right? And in Crewe, we said, if you're not a voter, that you don't have the same access, you don't have the same standing. So he's not doing this as a voter, right?
Well, Your Honor,
he's doing it as an advocate. So do you have any cases that suggest that's sufficient to find standing here, an advocate?
Certainly, Your Honor. First of all, in Gottlieb, this court recognized that competitor standing, a candidate has standing as a competitor in an illegally structured campaign environment. The Shays court.
Is he going to run again? Are we having an announcement here that Mr. Nader's going to run again?
Your Honor, I'm not at liberty to make such a disclosure.
The competitive standing cases are about that, right?
No, Your Honor, they're actually the injury in a competitor standing case is just the fact that the candidate was required to compete in an illegally structured environment. And that's certainly been alleged here, and there's substantial evidence in support of that allegation.
David, I thought I heard you say, goes to his status as an advocate since 1959.
That's correct.
All right. And so what is the authority for giving that status standing?
Well, I think that the relevance of that information is that it distinguishes this case from Common Cause, I believe, in which the court found, well, you're really just asking for information because you want to show that the other side committed violations and you have no conceivable use for this information. That's certainly not the case here.
Common Cause is as big an advocate as Nader, isn't it?
But in that case, the organization was seeking information on behalf of voters, and it said that the voters were entitled to have this information for the purpose of informing their vote. And the court said, really, all you're looking for here is information that violations occurred. And that is essentially a generalized grievance. The point here, which distinguishes...
What are you looking for here?
The information that the candidate is looking for here is the information that was required under the Act, which was not provided to him, regarding the reporting of the transactions, the services, the other things of value that were provided on behalf of the Kerry Committee and the DNC by these respondents who were never even served or asked to respond to the complaint. And again, that is the crucial issue in this case. The question here is, did the agency have an obligation to serve these respondents?
The agency doesn't have to hear from those respondents before it makes a decision, does it?
Correct.
I think to a similar line of question that Judge Randolph was asking. What do you get from this?
Well, here, Your Honor, the fact is that the agency relied on its supposed lack of information from the very parties it failed to serve or even contact, much less ask for a response, to say, well, there's no evidence here that would support a finding that we have reason to believe that a violation occurred. So, again, this is putting the cart before the horse. You do not, as an enforcement agency, refuse to serve a complaint and then say, well, I have no basis of knowing anything about the parties I failed to serve. That's the injury, or that's the harm from the violation that the agency did in this case. And to return to your point, Your Honor, about advocacy, certainly the candidate has use for this information as an advocate. Also, as we noted in our supplemental brief that was filed last week, there is ongoing litigation in this case. The respondents, one of the respondent law firms, is still pursuing attachment claims against the candidate, in spite of the fact that there was a grand jury presentment and multiple felony convictions arising out of the very proceeding in which the law firm received its judgment. And there's also a separate case in which the candidate is a plaintiff bringing tort claims for abusive process, malicious prosecution, and civil conspiracy against some of these same respondents. So clearly, this is not just a generalized grievance here. This is a live controversy. This candidate has use for this information, and therefore he has standing for it, both on an informational basis and as a competitor. And with that, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may. Thank you.
Mr. Nesson?
May it please the Court, my name is Seth Nesson. I represent the FEC. This case is really about whether the FEC is required to investigate over 150 individuals and entities just because it receives an administrative complaint that speculates that some of them may have violated the law. The administrative complaint was primarily about lawyers working on ballot challenges for free. But as Judge Henderson pointed out earlier, working for free on a ballot challenge is not illegal, even if the attorney does so because he wants John Kerry to be elected. The information that's necessary, the administrative complaint contained voluminous information about the ballot challenges themselves, but it consisted almost entirely of speculation about the critical issues that would have made that conduct illegal.
Why aren't you arguing standing? Are we wrong to be focused on standing? Because you don't seem to be focused on it.
No, Your Honor. We believe that standing would be...
Well, then why isn't that your first argument? Why don't you... Maybe it's not
only
as specific.
I was only doing so because much of the the discussion previous to this did not involve standing, but I do intend to get to standing. I can do so right now. We do not believe that Mr. Nader has standing here, that there's a cognizable injury in fact, or anything any injuries that he has suffered are at the hands of third parties and not the actions taken by the FEC. And as there has been some previous discussion, any injuries that he has do not seem redressable in this action. For example, I understand him to have made two separate arguments in favor of standing. One is this these attachment proceedings, but first of all, that's not fairly traceable to the FEC, the fact that that Mr. Nader's personal accounts have been attached. There's just no reason to believe that a state judge applying state law is going to revisit an 8-year-old bill of cost determination as a result of a finding that that some of the parties involved in the Pennsylvania ballot challenge may have violated the Federal Election Campaign Act, particularly in light of the fact that he didn't revisit it after numerous of the individuals involved in that ballot challenge were convicted of crimes unrelated to the Federal Election Campaign Act.
What exactly is the scope of the Federal Election Commission's enforcement authority?
The enforcement authority applies to any violation of the Federal Election Campaign Act.
What can it do?
What can it do in this instance?
Not in this instance, in general.
In general, the commission, if it were to determine that there is probable cause that a violation of the act has occurred, it enters into a conciliation period with the party that is accused of the violation. And in the event that they're not able to conciliate, the commission can file in district court asking a judge to remedy the situation.
Issue an injunction?
It's dependent upon the case. It can be an injunction or it can be a civil remedy, a financial cost as well.
The time for the civil remedy, and you're just under the general penalty provision applicable to all federal agencies and departments, right? You don't have a special penalty section, do you?
There is in the act a specific penalty schedule in which there's dependent upon the size of the violation and whether it was willful or knowing, the penalties would differ.
I thought you told us in your brief that you're subject to the 5-year statute of limitations.
Yes, Your Honor.
Totally applicable to all federal departments that seek penalty.
Yes, Your Honor. We are subject to the 5-year statute of limitations on the civil penalties.
Does the Federal Election Commission have any written policy regarding processing of complaints that are filed after the 5-year period has expired?
I'm not aware of a specific policy addressing that exact issue. However, the policies that have been put forward and are cited in our brief talk about, for example, the commission can dismiss or find no reason to believe dependent upon the likelihood of success and and other factors. So, for example, if a complaint were to be filed after the statute of limitations had already expired, the commission would likely take the opportunity to dismiss that case because it would not be a good use of commission
resources.
Well,
that's only with respect to penalties. What about injunctive relief? Is there any statute of limitations applicable to the commission in seeking injunctive relief?
I'm not aware of any decision that limits injunctive relief to a particular statute of limitations. So in a case where that was applicable and if the commission were to find that that was a desirable thing to seek, it could do so.
If Mr. Nader is correct, in the administrative complaint, would at least some of the parties have been required to make reports to the Federal Election Commission they otherwise wouldn't have made, that they didn't make?
Well, yes, Your Honor.
And so you could then come into a court and seek an injunction requiring the filing of the reports, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It's true that if the court were to decide that the commission acted contrary to law, and we did ended up proceeding in this case, there could be an order that, for example, these 527 groups at issue in the case would have to register as political committees if, in fact, that were true. The part of the problem in this case is that those 527 groups are defunct. They were defunct well before Mr. Nader ever filed this administrative complaint, and therefore...
That's not the only information he's seeking, right? And I'd like you to address the informational injury issue of standing. You talked about the attachments. I understand that. But why isn't this Aikens? Why isn't this he's seeking information that the FEC is obligated to secure for the public?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, initially I would say that Aikens specifically limits its holding to information that would be useful to voters. And, you know, there's very little reason to believe that any voter...
Does Aikens itself say that, or is that...
Yes, the Aikens decision says in it, you know, when it talks about whether this is a concrete and particularized injury, you know, informational injury directly related to voting, the most basic of political rights, is sufficiently concrete and specific.
Voting, not necessarily to voters, right? I mean, that could be a difference, right? Obviously everything that the FEC is charged with has to do with voting. We're now talking about the right of an individual who's brought a citizen suit, whether they have Article 3 standing under that. Are you arguing that Aikens stands for the proposition that only a voter can bring that?
No, I'm not making that argument, Your Honor. Okay. But what I am saying is that Aikens limits its holding to that subset, and that, you know, we would be extending Aikens to bring it.
Well, why isn't all of this have to do with voting? I mean, it's all about
Your Honor, the Common Cause case and the Crewe case that were discussed earlier, you know, were related to elections as well, and those were advocacy groups, and both of those were found not to have standing. And so I would present that this case is much more analogous to
Common
those
Cause
cases.
Was seeking to require the FEC to enforce laws. This is different than Common Cause. It's trying to get information to which the public is entitled. Isn't that's a different case than you have in Common Cause? And I don't quite understand how this is different than Aikens.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the Aikens decision discusses in great detail the potential uses for the specific information that they're trying to get. And when Judge Randolph and I think others were asking counsel, you know, how is Mr. Nader going to specifically use this information, you know, I don't think there was a clear answer. It's just he's an advocate for minor parties, but he doesn't have any sort of history that I'm aware of disseminating information about violations of election law, you know, and, you know, there seems to be a gap here between, you know, Mr. Nader's desire for the information seems to be akin to the Common Cause case in that he wants to get the bad guys. And the Common Cause specifically says, you know, that's not enough for standing. You need to want the information for a particular reason. And I don't think that Mr. Nader has
the information that they're talking about in terms of reports or filings or whatever is all public, right? It would be available, whatever the information is, it'd be available to every member of the public.
If there were to be an investigation, assuming the information was actually, you know, that these groups were able to put forward the information, yes, it would be available to the public.
Yeah, and United States versus Richardson, the Supreme Court held that the claim of need for or desire to get information that's undifferentiated from any other member of the public isn't sufficient to confer standing.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. If there are no further questions about standing, I'd like to move to some of the merits issues. Mr. Nader seems to, as was discussed earlier with respect to the coordination, it's not enough for the law firms to have coordinated with one another or to have coordinated with the ballot project, which is one of the 527 groups at issue here. The claim is that they were making illegal contributions to the DNC or the Kerry campaign. So if the DNC, if these parties were acting independently of the DNC or the Kerry campaign, there is no illegal contributions to those parties.
Did you argue that?
Yes, that was argued in our brief.
I know. Yeah. Well, I don't mean you. I mean, did the commission?
Oh yes, that was the principal reason in the first general counsel's report that's in the appendix for why there was no reason to believe that the DNC or the Kerry campaign had committed a violation. It was that and the possibility that the lawyers may have been working under the volunteer exception were the two justifications given. With respect to the notice issue that was discussed earlier, the Judge Lamberth found that it was harmless error, and rightly said, we believe that the commission has the authority to determine appropriate respondents. But even if it didn't, as Judge Lambert pointed out, it was harmless error in this case. Mr. Nader seems to argue that had all of these parties been noticed, there would have been some sort of flood of information in which the commission could have made a better determination. But in fact, the parties that would have received the notice are not required to respond at all to that notice. And the statute says that the response that they do give is that the response that is contemplated is that the respondent is supposed to say that why no action shall be taken against such person on the basis of the complaint. So it's entirely speculative to think that had these notices gone out, all of these parties would have sent in inculpatory information that would have benefited Mr. Nader. In fact, it seems highly unlikely that anything like that would have occurred, and to the extent that any of them would have responded, it would have been responses that benefit them and their alleged co-conspirators. If there are no further questions,
all right.
We'd ask the court to affirm the lower court. Thank you.
Why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to emphasize again here, the issue is not whether the respondents would have provided information that necessarily would have demonstrated a violation. The issue here is whether the FEC was required to serve the complaint on those respondents. And that it most certainly was required to do. The district court concluded that the FEC has no basis for its claim to the contrary. There's no case law, and their position directly violates the express terms of the act. And Mr. Nessen has just represented to the court that it's the agency's position that they do still have that authority. So this case has very important implications going forward. If this decision is affirmed, the FEC is now going to have the power to decide to whom to serve an administrative complaint and whether to serve it at all. And that is a direct violation of the act. And it obviously has important implications because it undermines
Judge Lamberth avoided that problem with the harmless error decision, right? You can say, look, no, the FEC blew it here. It's clear under the plain language of the statute they're supposed to do that. That was a mistake. But this is a mistake that doesn't make a difference for the disposition of the case, right? As long as they can convince, as long as they come up with a rational reason and give the reason for dismissing the complaint or for not pursuing the investigation, so then that's not a problem, right?
Well, then that goes to the second.
You lose, that's the problem, you lose, but in terms of creating a parade of horribles that you're suggesting for us.
Well, Your Honor, I suppose that the FEC could do it again and again, and there's no, and that's apparently what they intend to do. And the problem with that is that it was not harmless error. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a complaint that has serious, concrete evidence of serious violations and widespread violations of the Act, deliberate violations of the Act, with the, which the agency just refused to even investigate. And if it can do it in this case, and that can be called harmless error, then certainly it could be done again in the future, and apparently that is the FEC's position. If I could just point the court to the evidence here, there is certainly evidence of coordination which the FEC continues to disregard, including email records from the DNC to law firms, payments from the DNC to law firms, emails from the Kerry Committee to law firms. There is evidence. It's cited in our brief, and the FEC is just incorrect that there is no reason to believe that there was any coordination among the parties that were not served and the parties that were served. There is direct and uncontroverted evidence of that coordination. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.